could become a sustaining member or a first-time subscriber for as little as $25 a month or more. You can pledge as much as you can. That's 212-209-2950. There will be more of Radio Free Palestine as we continue throughout the day. Right now, it's 8 a.m. in New York, and coming up next is Democracy Now.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The Nakba happened in 1948. The Nakba continues in the present, today, in Gaza. The Nakba must be stopped in Gaza, and the Nakba must be reversed in the long run.
Palestinians across the globe mark the 76th anniversary of what they call the Nakba, or catastrophe, when some 700,000 Palestinians fled or were forced from their homes upon Israel's founding. We'll speak with a Palestinian historian. Then we hear from a doctor who saved the life of Senator Tammy Duckworth 20 years ago when she was injured in Iraq. He's now part of an American medical delegation trapped at the European hospital in Khan Yunis.
What we want is not only for us to leave. We seem to we're here because we have not been granted safe passage. We're supposed to leave after 2 weeks, and that date has passed. Normally, it's coordinated between the UN and the IDF, and this is not. We have been not given the green light, so we cannot really leave the hospital safely. We've been told that if we do, then we basically are responsible for anything that happens to us.
But first, House Speaker Mike Johnson is the highest-level Republican official yet to visit the criminal hush money election interference trial of former President Donald Trump underway in New York.
This is the fifth week that President Trump has been in court for this sham of a trial. They are doing this intentionally to keep him here and keep him off of the campaign trail. And I think everybody in the country can see that for what it is.
On Tuesday, Trump's former fixer, Michael Cohen, testified he discussed hush money repayments with Trump in the Oval Office. And over 500 faculty and staff at the City College of New York demand charges be dropped against students and faculty arrested last month. Many of those arrested face felony charges more serious than those faced by those arrested at Columbia and Barnard. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Biden administration's notified Congress of plans to send another $1 billion in arms to Israel, including tank ammunition, mortars, and tactical vehicles. The move comes as President Biden faces criticism from Israel and Republican lawmakers for pausing a single shipment of large bombs to Israel last week. The new $1 billion arms package is being advanced as Israel's widening its assault on Rafah and other areas of Gaza. More than 550,000 Palestinians have been displaced in recent days. The death toll has topped 35,100. The Palestinian Authority says 80% of Gaza's health centers are out of service due to Israeli attacks. This all comes as Palestinians across the globe are marking the 76th anniversary of the Nakba, which means catastrophe in Arabic, when some 700,000 Palestinians were violently expelled from their homes upon Israel's founding. Many Palestinians say they're facing a second Nakba today. This is Hussein Junaid, who had to flee the Jabalia refugee camp.
They deported us from the north of Gaza Strip. Here we are thrown on the streets. They destroyed our houses. They killed four children. They were martyred. Among them a doctor and a head of department. My four older children died. They were martyred. Our homes were destroyed. They shook us and they threw us on the streets. Who is looking for us? Which organization? Which area and which government? Let them see that we are thrown on the streets with our children and small ones who don't have milk and want food.
In the occupied West Bank, Palestinian truck drivers say they fear for their lives after Jewish settlers attacked a convoy of 98 Gaza-bound aid trucks Monday.
We went to the checkpoint, and after the check, we were surprised to see settlers on the roundabout of the checkpoint. They damaged the cars, they tore the tires off the trucks, they threw the contents of the truck on the ground. We gathered some of the products and sent some of those products onto a bulldozer and sent them to the sheep farms. Around 15 trucks were damaged. Their hull was damaged, windows of the trucks were broken, some drivers were beaten, some of the products were thrown away. And the whole loss for Hebron is around $2 million.
While Palestinians are marking the Nakba, Israelis have been celebrating their Independence Day. On Tuesday, a group of far-right Israelis, including a number of government ministers, marched in Sderot, calling for the resettlement of Gaza and the expulsion of Palestinians living there. Speakers included Israel's National Security Minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, who said, quote, we must return to Gaza now. He also backed what he called the, quote, voluntary migration of Palestinians from Gaza. Protests over Israel's war in Gaza are continuing across the United States. In Mountain View, California, hundreds of pro-Palestinian protesters blocked the entrances to a Google conference for software developers. R.L. Corin is a former Google worker.
We are sending a message that Google is the company that is providing the cloud infrastructure for Israel's violent crimes against humanity. And so we will hold the company accountable for this behavior. There is no reason, there is no need for Google to profit off of genocide. And so our demands, they're not radical, they're not difficult. It's really simple. Drop Project Nimbus and drop business with the government and the military of Israel that is guilty of genocide.
Nice to see you again.
Here in New York, students at CUNY, the City University of New York, briefly took over a library at the Graduate Center Tuesday night and renamed it Al-Aqsa University Library to honor Gaza's oldest public university, which was destroyed by Israel. At Harvard University, students have ended their three-week Gaza encampment after school officials agreed to meet to discuss divesting from Israel. Isra Al-Zamli is a student organizer at Harvard.
We've been organizing for Palestine on Harvard's campus for years. This encampment was not the beginning or the end of our organizing, but it was a beautiful moment of showing how much student power we can build. You know, President Garver has made it very clear from the beginning that he had no interest in negotiating with us, but we showed that we had the student power to actually bring him to discussions.
Prosecutors are wrapping up their case in the criminal hush money and election interference trial of former President Donald Trump. On Tuesday, Trump's former fixer, Michael Cohen, admitted he misled the Federal Election Commission about hush money payments made to adult film star Stormy Daniels. Cohen said he did so in order to, quote, demonstrate loyalty to Mr. Trump, unquote. House Speaker Mike Johnson, Senator J.D. Vance, North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum were among a number of Trump allies to show up at the New York courthouse Tuesday and do what Trump can't do, bash the prosecution and attack Michael Cohen's testimony. Primaries were held Tuesday in Maryland, Nebraska, and West Virginia. In Maryland, Angela Alsobrook won the Democratic primary for the U.S. Senate in her bid to become the first black senator from Maryland. She defeated three-term Democratic Congressmember David Trone. He spent 10 times as much money, over $60 million of his personal fortune, on the race to replace Ben Cardin, who's retiring. Former Maryland Governor Larry Hogan won the Republican primary. In another closely watched Maryland race, State Senator Sarah Elfrith won a crowded Democratic House primary to fill the seat of John Sarbanes, who's also retiring. A super PAC funded by the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or APAC, spent $4 million to help her campaign. In West Virginia, Republican Governor Jim Justice and Democrat Glenn Elliott won their respective Senate primaries Tuesday, setting up a face-off in November to fill the seat of Democrat Joe Manchin. Ukrainian forces are withdrawing from some areas in the northeastern region of Kharkiv as Russian forces continue a new offensive that has displaced thousands. The Ukrainian city of Vovchansk is reportedly in ruins following relentless Russian shelling. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has postponed all of his upcoming foreign travel amidst the new Russian offensive. On Tuesday, U.S. Secretary of State Tony Blinken visited Kyiv and vowed more U.S. assistance would be coming. Lawmakers in the Republic of Georgia have passed a controversial foreign influence bill that will require NGOs and news organizations to register as foreign agents if they receive at least 20% of their funding from abroad. Critics say the bill uses Kremlin-inspired measures to crush dissent and moves Georgia away from Europe and closer to Moscow. The bill has sparked weeks of street protests. President Biden's announced new tariffs on $18 billion of Chinese imports, including electric vehicles and solar cells. The tariffs on electric vehicles will increase to 100% in an effort to prevent Chinese electric cars from being sold in the United States, in a move that critics say contradicts Biden's pledge to combat the climate crisis by transitioning away from gas-powered vehicles. The Chinese government condemned the new tariffs, saying the moves will, quote, severely affect the atmosphere for bilateral cooperation, unquote. The U.S. Justice Department has determined Boeing has violated the terms of a 2021 deferred prosecution deal that was reached after the fatal crashes of two 737 MAX planes in Ethiopia and Indonesia that killed all 346 people on board. The DOJ's determination could reopen the door to the government prosecuting Boeing, which has been plagued by safety issues on its planes. And in Florida, at least eight migrant farm workers from Mexico died in a bus accident as they headed to work on a watermelon farm. 40 other farm workers were injured. The accident occurred when a truck collided with the bus carrying the workers. The driver of the truck has been arrested and charged with driving under the influence, manslaughter. In a statement, the Farm Worker Association of Florida said, quote, farm workers tend to be forgotten, but it's important not to forget farm workers, especially during such difficult times, unquote. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show with the criminal hush money election interference trial of former President Donald Trump. New York prosecutors are wrapping up their case that alleges Trump falsified business records in an illegal effort to influence the 2016 presidential election when he allegedly hid the reimbursement of a hush money payment to his lawyer, Michael Cohen, made to adult film star Stormy Daniels. On Tuesday, Trump's former fixer, Michael Cohen, admitted he misled the Federal Election Commission about hush money payments made to Daniels. Cohen said he did so in order to, quote, demonstrate loyalty to Mr. Trump, unquote, and described a February 2017 meeting with President Trump in the Oval Office at the White House about the hush money repayment. Cohen also recalled Trump trying to stop him from cooperating with federal investigators. In cross-examination, Trump's defense attorneys tried to suggest Cohen was motivated by vengeance against Trump. House Speaker Mike Johnson, Senator J.D. Vance, North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum, and others were among a number of allies of President Trump who visited the courthouse Tuesday to bash the Michael Cohen. This is Speaker Johnson.
This is the fifth week that President Trump has been in court for this sham of a trial. They are doing this intentionally to keep him here and keep him off of the campaign trail. And I think everybody in the country can see that for what it is.
This comes as a New York appeals court rejected Trump's request to overturn a gag order against him in the case. For more, we're joined by Ron Kuby, criminal defense and civil rights lawyer based here in New York, closely following all Trump's cases. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Ron. Talk about the significance of this week. You had Stormy Daniels testifying last week. Now you have Michael Cohen. The prosecutors began, and then he has been grilled by Trump's defense attorneys.
Michael Cohen essentially is the narrator of the entire case. He's the person who has come forward. He's tied all the disparate pieces together, the documents, Stormy Daniels, and everything else the prosecution has introduced. And he is the one who has firsthand knowledge of the actual deal that he and Donald Trump struck in order to pay the hush money, create a phony retainer, and ultimately falsify the business records. And while his credibility is important, and I think that most people can agree that he's a loathsome lackey. He was a loathsome lackey for Donald Trump. And he's just like every other mob underboss who gets called in a criminal trial. Although he's not as bad as the average mob underboss. He didn't actually kill anybody, arsonate anybody on behalf of his boss. But he is a guy who would have taken a bullet for the boss, did all these things for the boss, then the boss betrayed him, and now he indeed is out for revenge. Unfortunately for Donald Trump, and I hate to start a sentence like that, but unfortunately for Donald Trump, the story that Michael Cohen tells is an eminently believable story and is corroborated in significant respects. So the defense is going to have a hard time with him, all the more so because Trump's lead lawyer has never tried a criminal case in state court and has only defended two criminal cases in his entire life. This is not the on-the-job training, learning case that you really want sort of starting out in the world of New York criminal defense.
And Rod, first of all, greetings. It's been a long time since we've talked. But I wanted to ask you about two things. One is this you're a veteran of decades of criminal cases. Do you ever recall political leaders from Washington coming to a local criminal case like this, like the Speaker of the House and these other members of Congress and publicly criticizing the prosecution in the midst of a trial? And secondly, you've had a lot to say about the media coverage of this trial. So I'm wondering if you could comment on both the politicians involved in this case and also the way the media have covered it.
Unfortunately, Juan, I have seen this before. It's the advantage or disadvantage of being around as long as I've been around. We saw it, for example, and I don't know how many people even remember this, the Bernard Goetz case. Deranged white man carrying around a handgun shot down four black youth who he encountered in the subway. The subway vigilante had huge support. We had people like Senator Alphonse D'Amato coming to his defense, showing up at his trial. Of course, the Rudy Giuliani showing up and other political leaders. When there is a high profile case and you see elements that are attractive to really one side or the other, usually the right wing, they tend to show up and use the trial as a background to posture for their views. Mike Johnson, it was kind of remarkable in the sense that he did one of the things that Trump specifically was doing. He attacked the judge's daughter, which was kind of amazing. And as for Mike Johnson, remember, he's the guy who publicly announced that he and his son are internet buddies. They monitor each other's internet traffic to make sure that none of them are looking at porn or off-color websites. I wonder how Mike and Mike Jr. dealt with Stormy Daniels. Was anybody tempted to Google her body of work there, or did they just stay on the straight and narrow? It was a pretty disgusting show all around from Mike Johnson. The media coverage of the case, they tend to view this as a sporting event. The defense had a good day. The prosecution scored heavily here. The danger with that is we have no idea who's ahead or who's behind until the jury speaks. In a sporting event, you can say, okay, the Yankees are up by 9 runs in the 7th inning. They have never lost with this much of a lead, and you can confidently predict, happily, the Yankees will win. But you can't do that with a criminal trial. So much of this speculation is just uninformed because it can't be informed. And of course, the next body of uninformed speculation will be, will Donald Trump testify? Donald Trump will not testify. I think we should speculate on the reasons he's going to use to explain why he's not testifying. And I have, you know, my own selection on my bingo card. But of course, he's not going to testify.
And Judge Merchan, I wanted to ask you, if he is convicted, your sense of the likelihood of him imposing a jail sentence?
Judge Merchan is notoriously harsh on white-collar criminals. Judge Merchan is one of these judges who seems to think that the more you have, the more you've accumulated, the more advantages and privilege you've had in your life, the more you should really follow the rules. Because the rules make it, you know, easy enough for you to become wealthy. Like, if you're violating them out of greed or personal motivation, you will be sentenced to jail. So I have no doubt that Judge Merchan will impose a prison sentence. I also have no doubt that that prison sentence and the conviction will be stayed while Donald Trump pursues a whole plethora of multiple appeals.
I wanted to ask you about where you're going today to court to represent the climate activists arrested on Earth Day in front of Citibank headquarters. Many are now appearing in court. And also to ask you about the pro-Palestinian student activists at Purchase. I think 68 were arrested. This is State University of New York. Westchester DA said many of the charges will be dropped against them, as well as the students arrested at Fordham. You're representing all of these people.
Okay, so from the top, this morning in criminal court, in the summons appearance part, the climate protesters who were part of the New York Communities for Change set of actions. It's getting hot out there. It's going to be a hot summer. Actions. Young people, for the most part, climate protesters, desperately trying to get into people's consciousness about the existential need to save this planet, which has always been a difficult thing because people tend to look at the crisis of today and tomorrow rather than the crisis of a year from now. Unfortunately, today is now. The future is now. And so they are all charged with criminal trespass. I expect those charges will be dismissed. Following that, there are three Palestinian protesters at 100 Center Street today who disrupted the Easter vigil at St. Patrick's Cathedral in a respectful but firm protest against the slaughter in Gaza. Yesterday, the Purchase students began their series of appearances, and they are, for the most part, taking a three-hour course called Fresh Start. Sounds nice. And all of those charges will be dismissed. And the Fordham students are due on Monday, also in the summons part, where they face trespass charges. And it is likely those cases will ultimately be dismissed as well. I don't think I've missed anybody.
I want to thank you, Ron. Go ahead, Ron.
I just wanted to ask Ron, you for decades, of course, you have been one of the go-to lawyers in New York for social protesters, and especially during your period of partnership with the late, great William Kunstler. I'm wondering, have you seen over these years this kind of upsurge of young people protesting like you've seen in the last couple of years?
It's a great question. I tend to view these struggles, at very much the way William Kunstler did, as perennial struggles with each generation kind of rising up to do their part. We saw that in Occupy Wall Street. We see it now. And I just have mad respect for the young people who are literally risking their education, their careers, and their futures to stand up for the planet, to stand up against the slaughter in Gaza. And it's so impressive to see them, and I'm always happy to serve those movements in any small way that I can.
Ron Kuby, criminal defense and civil rights lawyer based here in New York. Next up, we go to Gaza to speak with an American doctor who saved the life of Senator Tammy Duckworth 20 years ago when she was injured in Iraq. He's now part of an American medical volunteer delegation at European Hospital in Khan Yunis, who's trapped. Stay with us.
What you coming about, baby? body getting lazy, clear blue sky, but it rains all the late fees. Did you get the payment? We had an arrangement. We don't want to watch the news, we just read statements. Yeah, do you want to
Baby by 100 Gex. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As many as 20 American doctors and healthcare workers on a medical mission at the European hospital in Khan Yunis in Gaza are trapped after Israel closed the Rafah border crossing into Egypt. The Intercept reported on the Palestinian American Medical Association situation Monday, describing, quote, Monica Johnston, a nurse volunteering at the hospital, said a primary concern of those who will be leaving is that new humanitarian workers be allowed in. Otherwise, the hospital campus is more likely to get overrun by the Israel Defense Forces. The plan, she said, is for the UN to do a test run from the hospital to the border Tuesday, only carrying UN staff. If those staff are not killed by the IDF, as one international employee was on Monday, then on Wednesday, two medical staff will be taken to the border and two new volunteers will be allowed in to replace them and so on in the coming days, she said. For an update, we're joined by Dr. Adam Hamawi. He is a plastic surgeon, Army veteran from New Jersey, who's part of the volunteer mission with the Palestinian American Medical Association at European Hospital in Khan Yunis. 20 years ago, in 2004, he saved the life of Democratic Senator Tammy Duckworth of Illinois when she was struck by a rocket-propelled grenade while serving in the Iraq War, losing both of her legs and partial use of her right arm. She told NBC News Tuesday, quote, we're shaking every tree, calling everyone to make sure we do everything we can to ensure safe passage of these doctors to whatever crossing we can get them to, Senator Duckworth said. Dr. Hamawi, thanks so much for being with us. Explain where you are and the situation you're in right now.
Thank you very much for having me. I am in the European hospital in Gaza, which is in Khan Yunis on the border of Rafah. We've been over here over about 2 weeks now, and we are continuing to work the best we can with the resources we have. There's no new updates about our status. So far, we have not been cleared to leave. We've heard many rumors on and off over the last few days about test runs and having two people leave, you were just explaining. We were supposed to have two people do a test run on Monday, but that did not, and I haven't heard anything since. So we are currently on standby. We're continuing to do our job. We came here to help the people, to provide medical care and assistance, and we're still here and we're still doing that. We are doing it with the limited supplies that we have, the limited resources that we have. It's tiring, but this is exactly what we need to be doing at this time because they have nothing else. We are kind of their hope here in terms of safety. They feel secure that our presence is here as well as the hospital because of what happened at places like Shifa and Nasser. They feel that as long as there are foreigners here, that they are protected. They are concerned also that what happens when we leave. So we completely understand that it's not just about us leaving. We want to make sure that there's continuous aid coming here and that we are replaced with another team with more supplies and resources so that they feel safe and that we can also make this place function like a hospital.
And doctor, could you compare the situation in other war zones you have been worked in, such as Iraq, to the situation in Gaza right now?
when I was in Iraq, I had the resources of the United States Army behind me. So we had, you know, a combat support hospital. We had multiple specialists. We had a supply chain, even though it might have been limited at some times. We continue to have that. And we were dealing basically with combat. You know, I was dealing with people who got injured because they were either soldiers, combatants. There were civilians that were injured, but it's nothing compared to what I'm seeing right now. 90% of who I see are civilians, and the injuries are just massive.
And in terms of your ability to access electricity, internet, phone lines, and communication to the outside world, what's it been like?
So we have intermittent internet at times. Electricity also is on and off. Electricity has been even worse over the last, I would say, 4 or 5 days, just because the fuel for the hospital is running out and they're trying to conserve it. So they've been cutting off electricity to some of the wards and trying to preserve it for like the operating room and the ICUs in order to make it last as long as it can go. There is, again, I have almost no cellular service. The wireless does get, you know, internet in some locations, and it's like random. So like, I was having a little trouble before getting on this show, so I was a little frantic trying to find a good spot and finally got it. So I'm glad I'm here.
Well, we really appreciate you making that contact with us. If you can describe the situation with the Israeli military moving into Rafah, cutting off the border crossing, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who are displaced from all over Gaza now heading back north, and what's happening in the hospital you're in Khan Yunis, and particularly the children that you're treating?
So most of my patients are children. My average patient's about 12 or 13 years old. They range from the youngest one I've taken care of is about 4, and the age goes up to like mid-60s or 70s. The people, since the invasion of Rafah, we've had a lot of the hospital personnel leave because they are trying to get their families out of Rafah. Many of them have either moved there from other parts of Gaza, or they have, lived there and they're trying to flee. I just saw a nurse this morning. I met him the first week that I was here. He hasn't been around for 7 days, and I just saw him. It was like, he looked dehydrated. He looked completely exhausted. He basically broke down and cried, telling me what he went through. He basically went to take his family out of their home and take them basically all along, you know, out into like a clear area that was a designated safe zone. He took his wife. He has 2 daughters, one that's 2 years old, another that's 3 months old. They went to a place that had absolutely no shelter. He basically said it's like the desert there. He said that they had no tents. They had no water. They had no food. The other day, he had to stand in line from dawn to about sunset just to get a jug of water for the family. He says that he has like absolutely no electricity, has no water. And he basically broke down and cried because he says, like, I feel like an animal. I don't know what to do. When we go to the bathroom, I dig a hole in the ground and we go there. And, you know, he says, his family a week before, his extended family, his uncle and his cousins were hit by a strike, an airstrike during the night, which killed most of them except one of his nieces and another cousin. So he said that they all passed away and died, were killed while they were sleeping. He said, I wish that would have happened to us, because at least we wouldn't have to go through what we're going through.
And Dr. Hamawi, 20 years ago, you provided life-saving care to now Democratic Senator Tammy Duckworth of Illinois when she was wounded in Iraq. Have you had conversations with her office about the situation there?
Yes, her office has been in contact with me, and I know she's doing everything she can to try to help us not only leave, but to provide that humanitarian aid into Gaza as well. I really appreciate everything she's doing.
K- can you talk about the United States, where you come from? On the one hand, you have President Biden announcing he's halting a shipment of 2,000-pound bombs because he doesn't want them used in Gaza. He also said he wants Israel out of Gaza. At the same time, on the eve of today, he announced $1 billion of weapons to Israel. If you could speak with President Biden today, what would you tell him, Dr. Hamawi?
I would tell him, like, what difference is it from a 2,000, you know, pound bomb from a 500-pound bomb? They're both going to kill civilians. He could stop this war right now. All he has to do is say, we are not going to give anything, and you need to stop. I don't care if you are our friend. If my best friend is a serial killer, I'm going to stop being his friend, and I'm going to tell him to do something. This isn't who we are. This isn't our country. This is not how I was raised. Not any of us, you know, what we were taught, what our nation is supposed to be. We're supposed to stand for freedom. We talk about that all the time. We claim to be the banner carriers for freedom across the world. And yet we have this, this foreign policy that is so, hypocritical in terms of providing a little bit of aid and a lot of bombs, and we're supposed to be, we're supposed to be like the United States of America. I mean, really, it's disheartening. It's going to haunt all of us when the truth, you know, I'm here, I see it with my own eyes. At some point in time, everyone's going to see it. I went out into Khan Yunis, and it is flattened. It looks like a nuclear bomb hit the center of town. There's not one building standing, and every building was entered in after it was bombed and completely vandalized. There's gunshots. There's, like, you know, graffiti everywhere that was placed after it was destroyed, making it completely uninhabitable. This
making
is not
it,
a
it
war
vandalized
against...
by who, Dr. Hamawi?
Well, the words on there are in Hebrew.
We only have 30 seconds. Why did you go to Gaza? You are risking your life.
I am a surgeon. I have skills. I have been in war, and I've been on humanitarian missions in the past. I feel that I could make a difference. I've been trying to come here, actually, since December. I've reached out to many medical organizations, seeing who is coming and who has a slot, and I was offered one, and I came as soon as that opportunity was offered. This is who we are. You know, we try to help people. This is what I do. I did this, you know, when I was in Iraq. I was proud to be with a team of U.S. Army doctors that took care of everyone that came into our combat support hospital. We took care of U.S. military. We took care of contractors. We took care of Iraqis, and we took care of other nationals. It didn't matter who they were, because we treat human beings. I had the best job in the country there, and this is what I continue to do. I treat people as humans. And the way I am seeing this war conducted is not how we conduct wars, and this is not how we are taught in the United States, and this is not who we should be supporting.
Dr. Adam Hamawi, plastic surgeon, Army veteran, now trapped at the European hospital in Khan Yunis in Gaza, where he's volunteering with the Palestinian American Medical Association. Again, 20 years ago in 2004, he saved the life of now Illinois Senator Tammy Duckworth, whose legs were blown off when she was serving in Iraq. Next up, Palestinians across the globe are marking the 76th anniversary of the Nakba. In English, it's catastrophe, when 700,000 Palestinians fled or were forced from their homes upon Israel's founding. We'll speak with a Palestinian historian in Amman. Stay with us. Somalia, México, República Dominica, Tanzania, fuera Yankee de América Latina, franceses, ingleses y holandeses, yo te quiero libre. Palestina.
معنى انا بحسب حسابي زمان استقبل ببنتي بعد ما بنتي اعلن افلاسي يوم العلم كان الوضع بدو الرضع صار الوضع بدو الردع لكل السيد بتحرر مستوطن بتلمس لكل مصاب حكيت الفان الف راق بالهجار الاعلان سلاحهم طيب فبركوت اما لما المي يدي برجع الواقع تمام.
So, Masoud, we are South by Anna Tijoux and Shadia Mansour. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, Juan Gonzalez. A far-right march to Gaza was part of the events this week marking Israel's Independence Day and the 76th anniversary of its founding. On Tuesday, a group of far-right Israelis, including a number of government ministers, marched in Sderot in southern Israel, calling for the resettlement of Gaza and expulsion of Palestinians living there. Israel's National Security Minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir, said, quote, first, we must return to Gaza now. We're coming home to the Holy Land. And second, we must encourage migration, encourage the voluntary migration of the residents of Gaza, unquote. This comes as Palestinians across the globe are marking the 76th anniversary of the Nakba, which means catastrophe in Arabic, when some 700,000 Palestinians fled from or were violently expelled from their homes, as Israel also carried out massacres upon its founding. Many Palestinians say they're facing a second Nakba today in both Gaza and the occupied West Bank. For more, we go to Amman, Jordan, where we're joined by Professor Abdelrazak Takhriti, a Palestinian historian, endowed chair in Arab studies at Rice University in Houston, Texas. He's published widely on the history of colonialism and anti-colonialism in Palestine and the broader Middle East. Most recently, he co-created Thora, a political education project on Arab and Palestinian history on the DIG podcast. He's also active with Scholars Against the War on Palestine. Professor, welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. If you can talk about the significance of this day.
Thank you, Amy. Well, first of all, I want to note that the numbers that are used by Palestinian historians now about the numbers of Palestinians that were expelled are at least 900,000. The Nakba was witnessed the destruction of Palestinian society, the destruction of Palestinian urban life. The two most important cities, the cultural and economic capitals of Palestine, Haifa and Jaffa, were lost during the Nakba. A host of other cities were lost during the Nakba. 530 villages were completely depopulated during the Nakba. And out of a population of 1.4 million, you had the vast majority being displaced. So this is a very significant event in Palestinian history. It's a horrific event. And what's very shocking about it is that it was an internationally sanctioned event in many ways. It was the byproduct of a policy that was created by the so-called international community during the mandate period when they instituted the mandate system under the League of Nations. And they did something very unique in world history, which is to sanction the establishment of a settler colonial presence in Palestine. So it's a very late settler colonialism, but it was a settler colonialism that led to the expulsion of the native population 30 years after the Balfour Declaration that instituted the settler colonial program in 1917.
And Professor Takhriti, the basis for the Nakba was laid by the British who held that mandate. Could you talk about their role in the repression of the Palestinians, especially in the 1930s?
Yes. So the British had actually been repressing the Palestinians from the very beginning. The main rule that was applied in Palestine was to arm the settler and disarm the native and to punish the native for developing any ability to conduct self-defense. So you had a very aggressive settler colonial movement develop in Palestine under British rule, and it was armed under British rule. It was trained under British rule. The British, like Biden today, were claiming that they were even-handed. They were claiming that they took the interests of both sides. You know, they were talking in these both-sided terms. But in reality, they were determined to establish a settler colonial project in Palestine. And they did succeed in doing that in horrific ways, actually. So, yes, Britain self-projects as an empire that was trying to do the right thing, in the same way that Joe Biden today tries to project this U.S. role as being fair and even-handed. But in reality, of course, they were pursuing this objective, which structurally led to the destruction of our people. Luckily, however, we have survived, despite the fact that they repressed us in during the 1936 revolt, which you were referring to. Although they destroyed the Palestinian countryside during that period, and they incurred heavy losses on us, that did not mean that our people did not continue. And even later on, when the settler colonist forces that were to establish the State of Israel expelled our population, our people continued to insist that they shall live. And today, we're witnessing the same level of resilience and insistence on resisting the reality of the Nakba, even today when we're facing the second Nakba unfolding in Gaza.
And also, could you talk about the efforts of the Israeli government to even prevent Palestinians from mourning what occurred in 1948, the Nakba law that is in effect?
Yeah, so this is a criminal trying to hide their crime. They've committed the crime. By the way, the current Israeli government, they're the descendants of the people that created the Nakba. And I'm talking here individually. So Netanyahu's father was a member of the Irgun, Benzion Netanyahu. That was a terrorist organization that carried out the ethnic cleansing of Yaffa. It bombarded the city of Yaffa, besieged it, mercilessly put its inhabitants under ruthless danger. You know, somebody like Yoav Gallant, who is currently engaging in major ethnic cleansing and genocide in Gaza, his father named them after Operation Yoav, which led to the depopulation and the expulsion of the majority of southern Palestine and its cornering into Gaza. So these people who were the children of those that committed this crime are trying to engage in Nakba denialism by banning the commemoration of the Nakba. They're trying to hide the crime so as to be able to continue committing similar crimes in the present. And this is a very important point. You know, I've been engaged in Nakba education for a long time, and I always say we have to apply a four-principled rule to Nakba education. One, the Nakba happened. We must reject Nakba denialism in all its forms, including, by the way, the forms that are promoted by Israeli historians that are sometimes presented as reasonable on the Nakba. In this show, you've hosted people like Benny Morris before. Well, Benny Morris is a Nakba denialist, not because he disputes the idea that Palestinians were expelled from their villages, but because he denies that it was actually part of a plan. In the same way that now in Gaza, what we're witnessing is a plan unfolding. It's intentional. We must insist on intentionality. So the first point when we're dealing with Nakba education is to insist that the Nakba happened and to reject denialism in all its forms. Secondly, we need to insist on the fact that the Nakba is continuing. And we have to understand that this is a colonial continuum. This is a structural process. It is not an event. And what we're seeing now in Gaza is very much connected to what happened in 1948. Thirdly, the Nakba must be stopped. So it's not enough to commemorate. It's not enough to talk about it. We have to stop it right now. And that means the first step to doing that is to stop the genocide in Gaza. And fourthly, it must be reversed. The Nakba must be reversed. And that means restoring Palestinian political and national rights, not only dealing with this as a humanitarian question, despite the gravity of the humanitarian situation. The humanitarian situation is a byproduct of the denial of the Palestinian political and national rights from the beginning of British colonialism to this very, very day.
Finally, Professor Abdel Razak Takriti, you have the Israeli Knesset member Ariel Kollner calling for a second Nakba, saying right now one goal Nakba, a Nakba that will overshadow the Nakba of 48. On the one hand, you have the Knesset members like these in Israel denying the original Nakba, but on the other hand, calling for a second Nakba. And in the United States, people like Congressmember Tim Walberg suggesting Gaza should be bombed, quote, like Nagasaki and Hiroshima. While at the same time, these Republicans insist no genocide is underway. Your final comment in this last 60 seconds.
Well, this is actually classic genocidal thinking. And it's also classic engagement with different audiences. On the internal audience front, The Israelis actually talk about genocidal plans openly, and they advocate them. And this has been happening for a long time. But by the way, this is not just a byproduct of the Zionist right. It existed in the Nakba was committed by the Zionist so-called left. It was the labor Zionism that committed the Nakba. They were presenting an image of self-defense to the external world, but they were actually engaging in very aggressive ethnic cleansing action and advocating it internally. The same is happening now. And we must understand that this is, again, an international process. The Israeli project is very much intertwined with American foreign policy towards the Palestinian people. They don't see us as human beings. They want to destroy us. But they know that they have to present it in self-defense terms so that it's palatable to the broader public. So in reality, however, this is just a racist criminal project that is leading and causing immense pain and suffering. As a descendant of Nakba survivors, it hurts me. It pains me to hear this discourse.
Professor Abdel Razak Takriti, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Palestinian-American historian and chair in Arab Studies at Rice University in Houston, Texas, speaking to us from Amman, Jordan. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show here in New York, where last night students and workers at CUNY, the City University of New York, peacefully occupied the school's graduate center in solidarity with Palestine, renamed its library the Al-Aqsa University Library. Al-Aqsa was Gaza's oldest public university, destroyed by Israel's bombardment. The students ended their occupation after a few hours when they said they reached an agreement with the interim president at CUNY Grad Center to share their demands with upper administrators, including calls to divest from all financial ties to the Israeli military, remove New York police from campus, and drop all the charges against the protesters, including those arrested last month when NYPD violently raided a peaceful Gaza solidarity encampment on the City College campus in Harlem. Over 500 faculty and staff at CUNY have signed a letter to the chancellor, Felix Matos Rodriguez, demanding that the charges be dropped against at least 173 people who were detained at City College compared to 109 at Columbia. Quote, a predominantly white private institution, the letter says. For more, we're joined by a signatory to this letter. Alex Vitale is professor of sociology, coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Project at CUNY's Brooklyn College, author of The End of Policing. His piece for The Nation, Campus Police Are Among the Armed Heavies Cracking Down on Students. And we're joined by Musabika Nabiha, a CUNY alum and Palestine organizer, took part in the Gaza encampment at City College, where keeping her location private for security reasons. Welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's talk about the disparity in the treatment of the much more diverse CUNY University campus. Alex Vitale, you've looked at this.
Yes, I think on the one hand, you have very restrictive protest rules put in place by the CUNY administration, which just harbors a deep fear and kind of disregard of its own students, faculty, and staff. And then you have CUNY putting forward much more serious charges towards their students than the Columbia administration or the NYU administrations did towards their own students. And this really raises some questions about CUNY's views about their own students and their deep intolerance of student dissent on campus.
And I'd like to ask Musavika Navi, how you took part in the Gaza encampment at CCNY, your thoughts on the administration's refusal to negotiate on divesting from companies complicit in the Israeli apartheid state?
Yes, the administration, both the CCNY administration and the CUNY administration, which includes Chancellor Matos, have refused to negotiate with us and instead chose to send in armed policemen to brutalize and violently arrest our protesters. And we know that the reason for this is that the demands that the students and workers are making are a threat to the university's profit motive. So the encampment put forward five demands. The first one was for CUNY to divest its $8.5 million from weapons and surveillance technology that perpetuates the colonization of Palestine. The second demand was for CUNY to institute an academic boycott of Israeli universities that are complicit in this genocide and in the broader colonization of Palestine. The third demand was for CUNY to express solidarity with the Palestinian resistance struggle. So this includes both uplifting and affirming the Palestinian people's moral and legal right to resist their colonization by any means necessary, as well as ending the repression and retaliation of pro-Palestine CUNY students and workers. The fourth demand was for CUNY to demilitarize its campuses, so to get IOF members, cops, policemen, and the U.S. military off of our campuses. And finally, the fifth demand was for CUNY to return to being a fully funded, tuition-free people's CUNY that offers a fair contract to all of its workers. And we know that the violent repression that we saw, you know, was not because of the tents or the flags or the banners or just because of the political education, the free food that we had at our encampment. It wasn't because of that. It was because the encampment's demands themselves proved a threat to the constant accumulation of profit and profiting off of genocide that CUNY is engaged in.
And are the charges being dropped? Is there any discussion of the charges being dropped against those who were involved in the encampment? Musavika.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So we know that some of the misdemeanors and summons have been dropped thus far by the DA. None of the felony charges have been dropped so far from the encampment itself. And we know that the DA cannot prosecute or would have a really hard time, you know, upholding these charges if CUNY administration refused to meaningfully participate in the prosecution. So we're calling on the administration to refuse to participate in the prosecution. And this is, again, why one of our demands is that CUNY stop retaliating and repressing its pro-Palestine students and workers. I mean, this is really the most egregious example we've seen of violent repression of pro-Palestinian organizing and views.
And Professor Vitale, we only have about 30 seconds, but you talk about the Cops Off Campus Coalition and the significance, for instance, of Portland State students successfully getting a disarmament of their campus police?
CUNY is spending millions of dollars for a security apparatus that fails to address the real security needs of students and is really there in moments like this to be a tool, a kind of private army for the administration to suppress student dissent. Campuses should quit wasting educational dollars on producing their own police forces that just reproduce the same violence and the same kinds of overt control of protest activity that we see from the NYPD and other local police departments around the country. So this is part of a national movement of young people saying, we don't feel safe just because you put a bunch of armed police officers on our campus. We want real services that meet our real needs.
We want to thank you both for being with us. Alex Vitale, professor of sociology, coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Project at CUNY's Brooklyn College, author of The End of Policing. And Musavika Nabiha, a CUNY alum and Palestine organizer. We'll link to the 500-professor letter at democracynow.org. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Democracy Now! Over WBAI New York. We're at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Just want to take a moment to ask for your support of this commercial-free, listener-sponsored radio station that brings you Democracy Now! Monday through Friday at 8 a.m. without commercial interruption. We're going to return to our continuing broadcast all day long of Radio Free Palestine. Today, May 15th, 2024, the 76th anniversary of the ongoing Palestinian Nakba and resistance to Israeli